review by our own faculty member and fiction writer, Jonathan Penner, who has generously offered to come in from his leave in order to introduce Elizabeth to us. So please welcome Jonathan Penner.
In time to come, those who have the honor to introduce Elizabeth Evans will need do little more than say those two words. In fact, I may be one of the last who can presume to tell anyone who she is. Elizabeth is an Iowan, born and bred and educated. She's been a winner of literary awards ever since her student days. Her stories are widely published and have appeared in a wonderful collection titled Locomotion, which I notice is out there on the table. What gives us special pride, of course, is that she's a part of our literary community at the University of Arizona, where she teaches fiction writing. Elizabeth's novel, The Blue Hour, was recently published by Algonquin. The reviews, packed with superlative praise, convey, of course, enthusiasm, but much more than enthusiasm. They also convey admiration and respect. They convey understanding, something every writer needs after years of typing words into the unpopulated ether. And they convey, in generous measure, what an author hardly dares dream of finding: gratitude, simple gratitude that this book was written. I think we're about to find out why. And now, those two words, Elizabeth Evans.
Okay, you guys are going to have to tell me if I'm in the right spot for this. That sound okay? Yes? Okay. Thank you all for coming. It's nice to see familiar faces and unfamiliar faces, too. Last night, I was in an audience. I went to see Tony Bennett last night. If you told me 20 years ago that for my birthday I would ask for tickets to see Tony Bennett, I would have laughed, but I did. And there's a part of me that really would have liked to have been somebody like Tony Bennett, you know, singing thrilling songs to people, big house of people that, you know, you sang these songs that they remembered and loved, and it was very stirring for everybody. And I thought, well, when I was thinking about coming in tonight, I thought, well, I'll read a poem by somebody. Since Tony Bennett got to sing all these songs that he didn't write, and they were really wonderful, they made him sound so good, you know, I thought I'd read this poem. I think I know it mostly by heart, but I have it with me in case I need some help. And it's a poem by William Butler Yeats, and it's called Adam's Curse. It's one of my very favorite poems. And it's about writing and love and puffing yourself up in both things. Adam's Curse. It's the poet talking to his old love, Maud Gonne. We sat together at one summer's end, that beautiful, mild woman, your close friend, and you and I, and talked of poetry. I said, a line will take us hours, maybe. Yet if it does not seem a moment's thought, our stitching and unstitching has been naught. Better go down upon your marrow bones and scrub a kitchen pavement or break stones in all kinds of weather. For to articulate sweet sounds together is to work harder than all these, and yet be thought an idler by the noisy set of schoolmasters, bankers, and clergymen the martyrs call the world. and thereupon replied, "That beautiful, mild woman, for whose sake there's many a one will find out all heartache on learning that her voice was soft and low. To be born woman is to know, although they do not speak of it at school, that we must labor to be beautiful." I said, "It's certain there is no fine thing since Adam's fall, but needs much laboring." There have been those who thought love should be so much compounded of high courtesy that they would sigh and quote with learned looks precedents out of beautiful old books. Yet now it seems an idle trade enough. We sat grown quiet at the name of love. We saw the last embers of the daylight die. And in the trembling blue-green of the sky, a moon, worn as if it had been a shell, tossed by time's waters as they rose and fell about the years and broke in days and weeks. I had a thought for no one but your ears, that you were beautiful and that I strove to love you in the old highway of love. And it had all seemed happy, yet now we'd both grown as weary as that hollow moon. William Butler Yeats. So what I'm going to do tonight is read from the Blue Hour. I'm going to read a bit of the first chapter. I won't read the whole first chapter because some of you have heard me read from this before, and I want to make it fun for you too. So I'll read a bit and then skip forward and read a little from the fifth chapter. Chapter 1. Some people complain because they can't remember things, say the name of the couple who once lived next door, or even the order in which events in a life began to go wrong. But I remember, not just names and sequences, but the lush depths of a chinchilla coat as it hung in cold storage, my father's hands rising off the steering wheel, even the optimistic green and white of the amphetamines a certain doctor prescribed for my mother halfway toward the end of everything. Which is why I also know that the very first glimpse my family had of the Bishop house included Channing Bishop, tan, tall, suddenly right there, bolting out the grand front door and into the summer rain at the precise moment that our realtor lifted his finger to the bell. "Well, hello there," my father said. A friendly man, laughing and smiling, he stepped to one side of the walk to clear a path for Channing Bishop. My shy mother, a little nervous, backed into a clump of wet evergreens. She raised her fingertips to the plastic rain bonnet covering her bun, a thing decorated with little balloons of red and yellow and blue. That bonnet had come as a premium with a loaf of bread. She raised her eyes towards its transparent roof and murmured to my sister Nancy and me, "I bet I look snazzy." How much does it matter that the year was 1959? Is it more important that it was 1959 or that it was early June, the wet trees and lawns throwing off a swarm of enchanted green light? While my mother struggled with the ties of the bonnet, Channing Bishop paused to yank a windbreaker over his head. "Enjoy yourselves," he said, then rushed off down the walk, like no one answering a door in our experience. No, like some cool TV detective giving the slip to farcically inept cops. I was 10 at the time and no sophisticate, but I felt certain my parents would take Channing Bishop's breezy exit as a snub, and my heart ached for them when he bolted through the opening in the handsome stone wall at the top of his walk and sped off in the silver sports car parked at the curb. If my father felt bad, however, he didn't show it. "Man, oh man, that is some car," he cried, while Nancy, 13, clawing her way towards glamour, Nancy whipped her eyeglasses from her skirt pocket in order to watch Bishop zip off down the street. Nancy was full of contempt for the stuff of our lives, and in general, I considered her arbiter of all action. On this occasion, however, I meant to show the world that I couldn't be even slightly impressed by someone who'd been rude to my parents. Along with the realtor, a tall man, beefy, with a butch haircut so short it was transparent, I turned away from the street and helped my mother out of the bushes and onto the walk once more. I can't remember a time when my mother didn't struggle with her weight, and when she was particularly heavy, as she was that summer. Her broad-cheeked face had what I thought of as an Oriental character, stereotypically placid, inscrutable. She had other sides, of course. In the company of certain girlfriends, she was often giggly and given to making odd noises to suggest delight, horror. Still, that day, before our arrival at the Bishop House, she'd worn only the inscrutable face, and I was surprised by the change that swept over her as she stood looking into the Bishop foyer. Something to do with the lift of her chin, a brighter eye, animal alertness. Now, just remember, we are only looking at this house for the experience, she said. It's not for rent, and it's way out of our league. She looked at Nancy and me as she spoke, but I sensed she really meant her words for the realtor. That Chan, the realtor boomed. He winked at my mother as if he knew her to be a woman accustomed to rude young millionaires. You'll get to know him once you settle in Meander, Mrs. Powell. He's quite a guy, really. You've no doubt bought Bishop meat. You know the products, if not the family. My mother didn't respond to the realtor's words, only stared ahead into the twilight interior, and I glanced at my father to see if this would suffice. No. At that time in his life, my father's main business was asphalt, and years of hopping out of his car to nudge along his cruise had left him with a ruddy face and hands. Still, while he stood outside the Bishop House, watching my mother, waiting impatiently for her to say something to the realtor, the color in his cheeks rose as steadily as some well-fed flame. Dottie, he said, Chuck was speaking to you about Bishop meat. For my mother to show even the slightest disregard for what my father wanted made goosebumps of alarm rise on my arms. She adored him. I was proud of how much she adored him. It seemed to make us royalty. Mom, I tugged on her arm, prompting her. We always buy Bishop's hot dogs, don't we, Mom? What? She gave me a brief, annoyed glance, then turned to the realtor. So this is that, Bishop? She asked. It would seem comical to most people, I'm sure, how grand and intimidating Meander, Illinois, with its 50,000 people, seemed to us after Dolores, Illinois, with its 7,000. But there was the uprooting of it, too. My father had assured us we would love Meander. We were going to grow rich there. Even so, Nancy had slammed doors, broken things, worked out a scheme to stay on in Dolores, in her friend Trudy's old playhouse. Then my mother had turned deadly serious and warned Nancy, if Dad feels the move's important, that's that. We were moving because my father planned to start a door factory in Meander, aluminum doors, screen doors, garage doors. Until we reached the Bishop House, we'd looked only at rental properties. We'd live in a rental until my father got his factory running. After that, he would build what he always called Dottie's dream house. He had already bought a wooded lot and had an architect draw up plans. The memory of the blueprints and drawings he scrolled out across our kitchen table still fills me with nostalgia. Rooms seductive as glades, rooftops dappled light and dark by the foliage of pin and ink trees, somehow more dreamily beautiful than any tree ever was in real life. Help! The realtor laughed as he groped in the dark main hall for a light switch. The rest of us still stood in the foyer. Nancy's long, thin nose sniffed at the masonry tang of the house as if it released deep instinctual warnings. Nancy was always sensitive to decay, odors of the body. She went pale and fainted with some regularity. "This place may be famous," she whispered, "but it smells like the underground lavatory at the park." The agent laughed. He was jumpy with laughter, and as he laughed, he patted at his big belly as if it were a faithful pet. I liked him, but I suspected I should beware any and all of his noisy charms. Earlier that morning, during our drive over from Dolores, my mother had mentioned that her phone conversations with the agent had given her the clear impression he considered us a bunch of hicks. Hicks had been a mistake on my mother's part. "Hicks!" my father had cried, and lifted both hands from the steering wheel as if to prove himself shocked beyond concern for our safety, which wouldn't have surprised me in town at safer speeds. I knew his theatrical bent. But at that moment, we were rushing down a country road. Wet gravel popped loose beneath us. One bad bump would have sent the car on a roll into a ditch through barbed wire and fields of corn. Nancy and I shrieked. Our mother closed her eyes. She looked as if she were going to sleep, had already accepted our doom. A gesture almost as awful as the way we drifted to the left just before my father lowered his hands to the wheel once more and declared in a voice both brittle and damp, furious and pained, "Hicks! Why, you don't know beans about what that man thinks, Mother." In the sudden blaze of the Bishop Holmes front hall lights, however, it did seem as if none of us fit properly into our clothes. And our clothes were the wrong clothes, too, weren't they? One of my father's socks had slipped into the heel of his shoe, exposed his pale ankle. My mother was weary. The little hitch in her step, left from a childhood bout of polio, showed more than it normally did. Her linen suit, though she continued to bestow upon it the honorific good, that old beige suit had grown too small in belly and bust, and after the damp day in the car, its fabric had the rusty, wrinkled look of rags hung up to dry beneath our kitchen sink. As for Nancy, though I usually considered her the epitome of teenage glamour, that day the hard crest of hair she had sculpted above her forehead gave her face the startled look of the bats caught by camera flash in my encyclopedia of the animal kingdom. And myself. Today, I hope I'd look at myself with greater charity. But at that moment in the Bishop Hall mirror, I saw only a skinny kid, dishwater blonde hair whacked to within an inch of its life, dressed so large I might have been the clapper inside a bell, practical eyeglasses, teeth bucked as a mule's from years of finger sucking. It occurred to me that I resembled those children the social servants agents sometimes brought to my grade school, scrawny kids who weren't sure what last name to use this month, kids we all understood would be gone in a few weeks, so why never seen again, so why make friends with them? The agent threw more switches, more lamps blazed, spotlighting the staircase, the ceiling of the landing, and the hallway high above our heads. "Aha," my father said approvingly. My mother smiled at his pleasure, then lifted her eyebrows at Nancy and me to let us know that we should smile too. Her lipstick was the bright red of those days, and considering how shy she was, it always struck me as brave of her to wear such a decided color. 18 inches thick, With the butt of his palm, the agent thumped the walls of the Bishop House. Imagine that. We all took turns thumping a wall, papered in what my mother assured us was real grass cloth, apparently a good thing, and in keeping with the taste of the home's famous architect, the agent added. My mother nodded. Clearly, she wanted to say something, and the struggle between her ambition to speak and her shyness turned her cheeks pink. Such moments always made me nervous, both that she would speak, that she'd lose her chance to speak, and I took refuge in a pointed examination of the front door's panes of colored glass, each one swirled with caramel, the dreamy, creamy stripes of agate and horn. My heart beat hard. My mother's opportunity was passing. It was too late. The agent began to turn towards the entry to the living room. Oh, her hand flew up like the hand of a schoolgirl. With a little gasp, she said yes. She was familiar with the architect's work, Prairie School, Oriental influences. My father jingled the keys and coins in his pants pocket, and when she finished, he smiled and said, is that right, Mother? The agent smiled too, then went on to recite certain facts about the house, its use of local limestone. Though deep-chested as a pigeon, my father stood just 5'6", and consciously or not, he'd developed a posture for talking to taller men, head held down, hands in his pocket, every now and then offering up a little nod. In this way, he managed to look polite, but also preoccupied, confident, even wily instead of small and deferential. Next, said the agent, and ushered us into the buffered green light of the living room. Except for a grand piano, the living room stood empty. Its drama was heightened by the way in which the house perched on an incline. We'd entered at street level, but the living room was two stories up and looked out into leafy branches of hackberries and elms and acres of bright rain-drenched grass that ran down to a creek backed by buff and gray cliffs. Gosh, I murmured. Behind me, the agent laughed. That's what I say, Penny. Gosh, what do you think, Bob? I bet your dad would get a kick out of seeing you set up in a house like this. Okay, I'm going to break off from that point in the first chapter. The family, the Powell family, does end up buying this house. And they learn that Chan Bishop is selling the house because his wife has taken the children and she's run off with his best friend. And he doesn't want to live in this house anymore, but he still wants to live in the neighborhood. So he's building himself a house nearby. And in the next chapters, the reader sees that the family move to Meander from this smaller town of Dolores. You get to know a bit about Channing Bishop and certain of the rather sophisticated neighbors from the area, particularly a woman named Margaret Woolham and her daughter Eleanor. You're also filled in on that the father is setting up this factory in Meander. And he's gotten into several deals like this in the past where someone's told him kind of a hard luck story. And his sympathetic nature has sort of been suckered into some not so terrific business deals. So let's see. So as we come up to chapter 5, the father's going back and forth quite a bit to his old businesses and his new businesses in Meander. So I think that brings you up to date. There's one reference to Channing Bishop comes by the house, and he makes a joke about Penny, the narrator, studying art history or something, because once when he'd been before and she was looking at art books while she was trying to eavesdrop on the adults' conversation. And I think that's everything you need to know. Okay, so this is chapter 5. According to the Meander newspaper's newcomers column, my family's favorite activities were hikes in the woods and water sports at their summer home. I look at this clipping today and wonder, hikes, water sports? Did water sports mean playing chicken on inner tubes? Did my parents say water sports, or was that something dreamed up by the newspaper man? Both reporter and photographer, he had been a bossy guy. My mother should stand beside the kitchen's barbecue. No, not there, here. What's the little girl's name? Somebody comb her hair, why don't you? With his knee, the photographer nudged Nancy closer to my father on the breakfast nook's banquet. Then he asked my mother, what are you saying you got in the pan there, Mrs.? Frijoles, read the caption that appeared in the newspaper. Mrs. Robert Powell stirs frijoles, a vital part of the international theme dinners enjoyed by the family of four. International theme dinners? In the photograph, Nancy and I and our father sit in the breakfast nook while, spoon in hand, our mother pretends to cook at the never quite functional but exceptionally handsome brick barbecue. Our postures are bad. I show all my big buck teeth. My father wears white socks. Still, we look happy in a way that sophisticated people, for all their handsome arrangements of limb and lips, rarely managed to look. One reason I married my first husband. When he saw that photograph, he said, sounding like some old softy looking into a pet shop window, aw, and you can even see your mom's not stirring anything in that pan, can't you? The afternoon that the newcomer's article appeared, Chan Bishop came by to drop off a copy he'd torn from his own newspaper. When I answered the door, he pretended to be shocked. What's this, Patty, he said, taking time off from your study of art history to fraternize with the neighbors? I understood that he teased me and that I shouldn't act too impressed by his manner. It alarmed me, though, that someone who didn't even know my name felt free to look into and comment upon my character. Actually, my name's Penny, I said. I sensed my mother coming up behind me and wished she would go back. My father had just called to say he'd be waylaid in Dolores another day or two, and even though my mother wore her glasses, you could see her eyes were red from crying. Also, whatever the ambitions of her shirtwaist, the fabric blue and white and depicting gardens and pavilions, men in powdered wigs down on their knees in front of women of small upthrust bosoms, it seemed to me to look like a bedspread. And I was, I'm sorry to admit, shamefully miserable about the fact. I wanted Chan Bishop to admire my mother. I wanted him to have the sort of teasing friendship with her that he had with Margaret Woolham, something that would define my mother as welcome in that world, too. Now, don't worry. Chan nodded at the record album and six-pack of beer, one already punched open, that he carried in his arms. I'm not descending upon you, Dottie. I was on my way to the Krauses for dinner. I just thought I'd drop by with this. He maneuvered his clipping of the newcomer article from his pocket. Oh, well, thanks. As if counting the pulses in her artery, my mother held her free hand upon her neck. The Woolhams and Chan Bishop made her nervous. I'd heard her say so to my father. Of course, Chan grinned. You girls could let me come in and drink a beer, and thus spare me a good half an hour of listening to the Krauses explain how they knew Haldus and I had trouble, but they hadn't wanted to interfere. I flushed at the name of his ex-wife. I thought of this Haldus as a criminal, an outcast. My mother, however, just smiled and said, ah, and invited him in. As Chan went into the living room, he insisted my mother must hear his record album. Nancy arrived home. Supposedly, she'd been at the library, but her whole being radiated with the marvelous adult odors of cigarette smoke and the perfumes she and her friends had tried on downtown. Since moving to Meander, Nancy had figured out how to approximate the hairdo worn by Elizabeth Taylor in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, combed back from the brow, then forward onto her cheeks. She now owned a tube of pale lipstick and a compact of cream beige powder for chin and nose. How humiliating, she cried when my mother handed her the newcomer's clipping. Anyone can see there's nothing in that pan. Oh, pooh, said my mother, as if she saw beans plain as day. The neighborhood cleaning lady, Bea Dart, now cleaned for us, too, and as Bea walked through the hall with a vacuum cleaner, my mother called, Bea, do you think this pan looks empty or not? Bea Dart set down the vacuum, then stepped into the kitchen. She was probably no older than my mother. She may even have been younger. But she was worn, huge, her calves above her anklets, thick with bulging veins. The skin beneath her eyes, a wrinkly velvet brown that made me think of the gills of mushrooms. Out in the living room, the stereo needle made a little skip. Then a song sung in French by some husky voice chanteuse filled the downstairs. That must be Mr. Bishop, Bea said, as she picked up the newspaper photo. He likes that foreign stuff. She handed the newcomer's article back to my mother. You look real pretty there, Mrs. Powell, she said. I nodded, happy and grateful. Oh, said my mother. I mean, thank you. Thank you, Bea. But look at this pan. Do you think people would know it's empty? Well, Bea cocked her head to one side. There's no reason somebody might not think that you got a little bit of something in there. Then she and my mother went out in the hall so my mother could locate her purse and write out Bea's paycheck. I look ugly. Nancy seized up the clipping again. I don't even look like this now, but everyone who sees it will remember what a dork I was when school started. Chan, entering the kitchen, placed his hands over his ears, his eyes, his mouth, the three monkeys of discretion. I was pleased that he assumed we'd understand what he meant, but Nancy stomped from the room and up the stairs. With a laugh, Chan took a seat on the kitchen nook's banquet and pulled me down on his knee, which meant I immediately pegged him as the type who showed his friendship for adults by acting friendly towards their sons and daughters. Still, I stayed put. I didn't respect myself for it, but I seemed unable to resist even what I took to be fake affection. When my mother returned to the kitchen, Chan explained to her that he'd been in France that summer. He'd heard The Woman on his record album while he was in Paris. She smiled and nodded. She was working on dinner, a meatloaf of hamburger seasoned with Lipton's onion soup and ketchup, and extended with oatmeal and eggs. I pointed to the empty record cover Chan had set on the table. A tousle-haired young blonde woman clad in only a man's pajama top, throwing open her shutters on a view of the Eiffel Tower. Is that the singer, I asked? Chan laughed. Afraid not, Penny. This is what we pretend the singer looks like while we listen to her. He tapped the cover with a fingernail that was as pale as shell against his tan skin. Then he murmured, but Haldus, she had legs like this gal. I glanced over at my mother, now busy working the soup mix into the meat. On behalf of her and a host of others, including perhaps my future self, I said, imagining myself clever and opaque, but don't you think that name Haldus It sounds like a mineral or maybe some kind of fish. Chan laughed, then looked back at the photo. Haldis loved having her picture taken, he said. My mother glanced up from her work with a droll smile. According to our lights, Chan had just told us something that put his ex-wife in the wrong, revealed her conceit, and this meant that we were all becoming friends. Chan, however, didn't return my mother's smile. He stood abruptly, tipping me from his knee, and while my mother quickly looked down, abashed, he walked to the refrigerator, opened it, and took out one of the beers that he had stashed there. Haldis. He stared into the blank face of the refrigerator. His old refrigerator. Haldis's and his refrigerator. Haldis was a true beauty, he said. And then he did look to my mother for a reaction. His face a little sly, like the face of a boy who watches to see if his parents will reprimand him for some minor but dirty bit of business. With a quick stroke, my mother cracked an egg on the rim of her metal bowl, tossed the shell into the sink. A true beauty. The words reverberated in my head like the last words of a quarrel. With all my heart, I wished that Chan would say, "You're a true beauty too, of course, Dottie." I didn't, however, expect to look up and see him moving towards her, reaching an arm around her, and I shrieked in alarm, "Mom!" Instinctively, she shrieked too. "Hey!" Chan turned, hands up in the air. "This is all I was after, ladies." Slowly, like a criminal showing his weapon to the police, he brought forth a can opener from behind a curtain over the sink. "See? It's my old church key." "For heaven's sakes, Penny." Red-faced, my mother stared back into the bowl of meat. "For heaven's sakes, you half scared me out of my skin. Just go find something to do." "That's right," Chan grinned. "Go gargle with peanut butter, kid. Go play in traffic." My mother started to protest, then stopped herself and laughed instead. To show I was a good sport, I smiled too. But Chan was done with me. He turned toward my mother and began to tell her how Haldis had bought the material for the kitchen curtains on one of their trips to Bali. "Do you know Bali, Dorothy?" he asked. "Dottie," he called her, "Dorothy." He went back and forth. "The people in Bali say they don't have art, Dorothy. They say no matter what they do it as well as they can." My mother looked up from patting the meat into a loaf pan. "That's nice," she said. "So everything's art then." "Everything or nothing." Chan took a long drink from his can of beer. "So, where's the boss today?" he asked. "Is he off making roads?" She nodded, then a little teary-eyed, bitter lip. "She misses him," I murmured. Chan studied her for a second, then tipped the last of his beer into his mouth. "Of course she does," he said. "He's a lucky guy." I liked Chan Bishop for saying that, and later, after he'd gone on to the Krauses for dinner and Margaret Willem came by, I tried to think of a way I might repeat his praise in her presence. I'd settled myself in the breakfast nook with colored pencils. It seemed a legitimate occupation while I eavesdropped on the women's conversation. The meatloaf was baking alongside three big potatoes. I was drawing a J with black eyes made extra bright by the squares of reflection I'd included on each pupil. And Margaret Willem was telling my mother how Chan had given Haldis a Mercedes-Benz after she left him. "Can you imagine that?" Margaret said. "Mercedes-Benz," I mouthed, just as I mouthed the words my mother had written on an index card pinned to the bulletin board. "Dialectical, sang-froid, etiolate." I'd never heard of a Mercedes-Benz. I pictured a wild animal, wild, furry, made up into a coat of unimaginable splendor. Just recently, I'd learned about chinchillas when Margaret Willem brought home hers from the cleaner's cold storage. Each fall, according to Eleanor Woolham, her mother installed the chinchilla and a blue fox in the cool closet of the family guest room. One afternoon, home alone, Eleanor and I had become so intoxicated by the fur's glamour that we'd stripped naked in order to take in more of those lofty coats, the cool slip of their satin linings. Jan said he'd take us out to his parents' home sometime, my mother told Margaret. Is it really as grand as people say? Oh, Margaret emitted a regal blast of cigarette smoke. It's impossible, really. They live in just a fraction of it. Then she went on to tell my mother how the senior bishops were charming, really, but they'd marched Chan and his brother off to schools in the East at some awful age. 6, I think. They were hardly home until they came back to run the pack. Margaret stretched her mouth wide to dramatize her horror, then let loose her throaty, exasperated laugh. Who understands men? As soon as Chan and Haldis had Mike, Chan started talking about sending him off to school. They fought about it, believe me. In a quiet, careful voice, my mother asked, did you like her, Haldis? Oh, Haldis was wonderful. The two couples had wonderful times together, season tickets for the opera in Chicago, some terrific vacations, plus the kids were friends. My mother nodded. I suppose you were shocked about what happened. Margaret tilted her head to one side, looked my mother over a bit. Well, she drawled, no, honey, I wasn't shocked. Everyone else seemed to be, but no, I wasn't. My mother glanced my way, then said, her voice lowered, I guess he's having a hard time of it. I didn't mean to count, but he had an open beer when he arrived, and he finished 2 more while he talked to me. Margaret tapped a teasing finger on my mother's arm. Maybe you made him nervous, Dorothy. He usually comes over for coffee in the morning before he leaves for the office, and from what I gather, he thinks you and Bob are Mr. and Mrs. Wholesome Americana. My mother eyed the clipping on the counter. I certainly look wholesome in that, she said, positively corn-fed. Margaret laced her fingers in a girdle across her flat belly and explained that she had just spent a week on unflavored gelatin mixed with bouillon. She knew all kinds of tricks, she said. Cigarettes helped, of course, and sit-ups, and, she half-whispered, Haldis and I used X-lax once. X-lax? My mother's eyes opened wide. I felt an outrageous excitement at the idea of my mother changing into someone like Margaret Woolham. And without thinking, I blurted, you know, Mom, Grandma uses X-lax. The women looked over at me then. Without a word, they walked into the living room. A little while later, on my way upstairs, I heard them discussing the replacement of our living room furniture, my mother doing her best not to appear to ask advice, and Margaret doing her best to appear not to offer it. And what about classes at the junior college? My mother explained she wanted to learn French. Margaret said something that I suppose must be French, and my mother, sounding shy and grateful, and a little impatient too, asked, well, what did you say? Margaret laughed, then translated in a sexy voice. Have you a room for 2? I found Nancy in the upstairs hall. She was scowling and wore only underpants and a shirt decorated with the design of blue American coins. On the floor in front of the hall mirror, a fashion magazine lay open to an article entitled, Do You Have Great Legs? Knees touching, Nancy bent from the waist, inserted a pencil between the fleshiest part of her thighs. According to the magazine, she explained, if she could do this without the pencils touching flesh, then her thighs were not too fat. It must have been October by then. Nancy had acquired a boyfriend, not the high school Greek boy of her dreams, but a classmate shorter than herself, with a high, squeaking telephone voice. An unremarkable boy, but enviable all the same. The entire world seemed to be in sharper focus for Nancy now that she had a boyfriend to escort her through it. I lay down on my stomach to consider the legs of the model in Nancy's magazine. They were like the legs of the woman on the cover of Chan's record. Long, slim, supposedly like the legs of his ex-wife, Haldus. I thought of what Chan had said about Bali, and then I thought about the photographs of fat Russian women that the newspapers ran now and again. Enormous women shoveling snow from city streets or without what Westerners would have considered requisite shame, spreading their great selves across crowded beaches. Those photographs, they always struck me as some sort of encoded warning to females who might aspire towards equality. I rolled onto my back. Nancy, I said, did you ever think, what if everyone were beautiful? Would nobody be beautiful then? That's impossible, Nancy said. That's dumb. But what if it were possible? And how do you know? Look at dogs, how dogs look alike. All cocker spaniels, all German shepherds. Maybe someday we'll all just be types. Nancy didn't pay attention. Her voice dreamy, distracted, she said, I'm going to buy a raincoat like the one that lady's wearing on the cover. That's the same kind of raincoat that Audrey Hepburn wore in Love in the Afternoon. All given out even, and we never had to worry about those things. Forehead wrinkling, Nancy bent with her school ruler to measure the fold of flesh that formed when she executed a knee bend. She made a notation on a piece of paper, then fixed her bright eyes upon me and announced, Mrs. Willem says Haldus Bishop was so skinny her hip bones stuck out in front of her stomach. Haldus Bishop? Why did everyone talk about Haldus Bishop? Some people don't have food and clothes, I said. What if we didn't have food or clothes or a place to live? Penny. Nancy hung her face over me. All of a sudden, she started to grin. Now, promise you won't tell. Tell what? Well, I overheard Archie tell Dad that they'll clear over $1 million the first 2 years the door plant's in operation. The blissful feeling of release that spread through me almost immediately turned to suspicion. How'd you hear that? I asked. Listening in on the phone. She raised one full hand of fingers and a thumb from the other hand, wiggled them in the air. 6 zeros, she said. I rolled onto my stomach. 6 zeros formed in my head, zeros with stick legs and arms, fat men tumbling into one another like something out of a math book, a drawing meant to make children laugh while they learn. Oh, wait, I said, 6 zeros is nothing. Nancy frowned. Well, a 1 and 6 zeros. I tapped my finger against the 3-prong outlet on the wall beside me. You know those masks where one's laughing and one's crying, I asked. This thing looks like the crying one. Nancy glanced my way. In a flat voice, she said, that's tragedy. I pushed myself up onto my knees. Near the electrical outlet, a small metal flap led to what I knew was one of many tiny tunnels belonging to that house's obsolete vacuuming system. I lifted the flap and pressed my ear to the opening. In stories, when a person located a spot like that, she'd end up hearing everything she wanted to hear or didn't want to hear. And it seemed unfair to me that the tunnels in our house had nothing to say. All they gave back was a dull murmur you found inside seashells, the tiny roar your blood made as it moved about inside your head. Thanks. You're a great audience.